Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday night discussion group. Tonight we'll be discussing Chapter 40 in Stephen Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception. Faulty medical advice is making us worse. Guys, this is the last chapter in the book, and then next week we'll have Steve here himself an hour early at 8 o'clock going and answering questions himself. But this is an awesome this chapter kind of sums everything up. So we're really going to have a good time tonight speaking about this. Chapter 40, Beyond TMS. And it's got the answers in there to heal from TMS, I can tell you that. Before we start, I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician, or as we like to say, a TMS physician. Okay, with that said, we got Bruce MC that's got the summaries, and go ahead, Bruce.
Well, as we had such a long talk, first I forgot everything that I was going to say, so maybe that'll be helpful in a way. I won't have anything prepared, but Chapter 40 is entitled Beyond TMS, and of course this is the last chapter of Steve's book, as Herbie said, The Great Pain Deception. And I think what's interesting about this chapter is that Steve has, as an author, been playing poker with us. And this chapter is finally where he lays his cards on the table and tells you what the purpose of the book was. And amidst all of these metaphorical... all this metaphorical hyperbole that he's introduced in this chapter, he actually comes on the next to the last page and tells you what this book is about. And he said, I made this book a comprehensive health book rather than just focusing on pain itself. He meanders from the psychological, the physical, and back and forth, knowing that they could never be separated. And he says that pain is a part of life and the philosophy upon which that life is based. And so this book attempts to shed life on the larger life, which is the origins of pain, not merely the characteristics of it. And this is what he says. This book isn't about what TMS is. It's mainly about why TMS is. My intention is to provide a map that shows the many roads leading out of conflict. It's up to the sufferer to decide which fork in the road to take on the journey to healing, persistently plodding toward truth, away from man-made problems. Well, he introduces the chapter with a quote, as he does all of the chapters, that's sort of like an epitaph from Chang Tzu. The most tragic events are a great benefit to mankind, and therefore necessary. And this seems to echo one of the examples that he gave earlier of Michael J. Fox, who would not say that he would not relinquish getting Parkinson's disease because of all of the things that it taught him about life, how to value life more. And this guy, Chang Tzu, it's an ancient Chinese work, actually, by an anonymous author who's got that name applied to him, and he was writing in the 3rd century BC. The Chang Tzu is composed of a large collection of anecdotes, allegories, parables, and fables, which are often humorous or irreverent in nature. Its main themes are of spontaneity in action and freedom from the human world and its conventions. And that's the Tao. And it's about a Chinese philosopher who is a wandering sage who pursues the Tao, and he's always happy. And that's where the theme of happiness shows up again at the end of the book, where Steve says, happiness first and good health will certainly follow. He ties everything together thematically, I notice. In that first section, he says, what I learned, my road home, he said, I saw the he quotes Michelangelo. I saw the angel in the marble, and I just chiseled till I set him free. And I think he's talking about Michelangelo when he went to the Perugian quarries
south
of Rome to select bits of marble to carve, big chunks of marble. And what Michelangelo would do was look at the marble first and see the form latent in the marble and decide what shape it was destined to become. So this was part of a selection process. And it's like part of what Steve is saying afterwards. I learned that there was a part of me hidden by me, from me, for reasons unknown to me, that makes me who I am, that I never knew existed, that causes all my physical effects. He's saying that what he was doing in the process of his healing was a selection process like Michelangelo, finding that form that was hidden from him, that was still there in the marble to begin with. It's like the shadow self that he discovers on his journey of discovery and recovery from TMS. And he links all of this together with so many different anecdotes and links to what different people say. You could go all night. He quotes Robert Scher, MD. We learn self-punishment during early separation trauma, and this is a state of helplessness under life threat. He talks about the whole fight, flight, freeze, where we become traumatized and hold those emotions frozen inside us. Again, he's going back to the marble, that initial metaphor that he's put in, that he's laid in there, and saying that you have to release that. And that's what Michelangelo does with his chisel when he carves the angel. And he also, he lays his cards on the table again here. He never says this anywhere else in this book. He says, this book is about revealing human misconceptions. If you believe you are failing, you will fail through unconscious actions. As your shadow tries in desperation to hide of yourself from you, fear. If you believe in hope, there isn't enough light to shine on all the possibilities in healing. With hope comes calm, and from calm, peace. And he says one of the most important ways out of early separation and isolation is what Clancy McKenzie told him. And that's, don't forget to mention forgiveness. And that's self-forgiveness, forgiving yourself. And that's the great liberation there that releases the angel from the marble. And that's what he's done in the process of this book. The whole writing of the book is like what Michelangelo did. He's released himself, this hidden self inside of himself that he describes. I don't know if we can take off from there.
Is this not the part of the ego that everybody hides? They don't want to show the world. They got it in there, and it's like, you know, this on the outside, this is who you see. But when I get home and nobody's around, then this ego part that you don't want to show nobody, the real you comes out, and that's pretty much the whole idea of TMS, right?
Yeah, and he says that when his wife was handicapped, it cut my heart in two, and that was an event that was on its surface terrible, of course, but it was also like Michael J. Fox, or it was like what Chang Tzu says, the most tragic events are a great benefit to mankind and therefore necessary. It's like that whole concept of the fortunate fall, felix culpa. You know, we fall from innocence, and in that process it gives us a chance through experience to recover radical innocence. That's my two bits worth. But
yeah, I mean, is when you mentioned Chang Tzu here, ain't that talking about through through this hardships, you gain new strength, new knowledge, new wisdom, new power to be able to go on and do better in life, right?
Yeah, it's like Yeats says in Lapis Lazuli about the sages that are cut into the stone. Their ancient eyes, their ancient tragic eyes are gay, are happy. Yeah. It's like this mendicant Taoist priest who wanders along through suffering, and yet happiness comes first. He's a laughing monk. That's the message of the Tao. And I think that's very important. That's why he put that at the start as the epitaph, because that, yeah.
Chang Tzu was a laughing monk?
No, he was a Chinese monk in the 3rd century BC who formulated the Tao. And he was a mendicant, wandering monk who was noted for his impishness and his playfulness. And
okay.
Comes this theme of happiness in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of suffering. And he's saying that's the way through this. Happiness first and good health will certainly follow.
I mean, how much is that played into your healing, Bruce? I mean,
I think many of us notice as we go through TMS recovery that our relationships with others become less guarded, more authentic, more direct, more sincere, and you access emotions that you previously hid or covered up behind this. Where does he talk about the mask? People who wear masks seek to hide their faces. It takes energy to design and build a mask. But when you take off the mask, then the emotions that were causing pain are released. You're not putting all that energy into a false front. And the false front is what causes the pain. It's like an equation here.
Yeah, wasn't it Lance Armstrong that when he finally told the truth, about the steroids or whatever, didn't he say something like, I'm glad I got it off my chest?
Yeah, probably a whole lifetime, too, after the kind of repression he suffered at the hands of his stepfather. He was a guy who learned suffering very early.
There you go, yeah.
What do you think, Horst?
That was a great summary, Bruce.
Yes, it was, man. Thank you, Bruce. That was awesome.
I love it. And I love this chapter. I love the way that he ties it all together. It feels like, okay, he really is kind of laying his cards on the table here. He's talking about ego. I think clearly throughout Steve's book, ego is a really important idea, this idea that we hide our true selves because we're trying to protect our egos, possibly for reasons which derive from our super egos. We feel like we need to be a certain way. We want to preserve our image as being a good person or a perfect person. And so he's talking about kind of forgiveness of ourself and allowing ourselves to accept who we really are and become who we really are. That was
up at the top of page 339, he says, I'm often asked if I could sum up TMS in one word. Here again, he's laying it on the table. Although tension results primarily from id-superego conflict, as we all know, if I had to give the cause of pain an emotional label, it would be guilt or shame. Guilt is the personal reaction and shame is a social reaction to embarrassment. We cannot, that says a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. He gives us all these examples of what to do in this last section of the book about how to fix yourself. But this is where he really lays it all on the line in this last chapter. It'll be interesting to see him next week. And I'm sure everyone will have a lot of questions to ask about what he does.
Big time. Does anybody got maybe anything they want to talk about, that when you get to doing something you like, how the pain that you might have or anxiety lessens?
Well, tennis time here. I experienced it a couple hours ago. I did a tennis practice, and when I do that, I practice my serve by myself, so I can really focus, and it's a meditative experience. And like, I don't go to, religious, not a religious community, but for me, my church is on the tennis court, and that's when I get some of my best thoughts, and I could concentrate so much that I could feel the service motion in my hip, and after about an hour of that, I was walking really well. Got in my Jeep, drove home about 1 mile, got back, and stiffened up again. So for a while there, it went away.
Wow, that's great, Ken Stallman.
And also, today I discovered something about instead of trying, I didn't try. I relaxed my hip joint, which is my area, and I didn't try to push it, didn't try to whatever, but just to let the muscles relax, and they did. And it's kind of a breakthrough. And now I'm going to try to remember that on the court when there are people, live bodies on the other side, which entirely changes the dynamic. And that's where practice comes in. And for me, I need to do that alone on the practice court to get to those breakthroughs, and then sleep on it, like in TMS. And then hopefully some of it will residually be there, and I'll remember it, and keep practicing until it's just there autonomically or automatically without having to give it any thought or any more practice.
Awesome. Anybody else want to comment on the happiness factor, or the factor to where when you get to doing something you like to do, or something that can get your mind off, your body or the pain, then you start to feel better, at least while you're doing something you like doing?
Well, I noticed that over Christmas, I just found out I had TMS in March, but I've had a lot of pain for 2 years. But I noticed
Okay.
over Christmas I could do things, like once I started going out, like to my sisters or to my in-laws, then it got easier. And beginning of January, I had to go to a church function. Like I've had just a real sore back for a long time, so going to a church function, it was pretty hard. But I went and I made it. So I'd kind of gotten used to going to events for 2 weeks because I had no choice, and I made it. So, so you just kind of train yourself. I guess that's what I was doing. And then, I don't know, then I learned I had TMS in March, luckily. So now I can do it more consciously, learn how to go through
Awesome.
things more consciously. But at Christmas, I was doing it unconsciously, and I was succeeding to some extent, randomly, it seemed to me, but yeah.
So you did have some relief when you went and did what you wanted to do, right?
Yep. I
Okay.
kind of got used to doing it. My body kind of adapted. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
And then I
Good.
guess I could see I was actually doing it. I could see my success and then do it again and do it a few times in a row, you know. But anyway, now I've been started following the TMS stuff at the beginning of March, and I'm improving a lot a lot quicker. Yeah.
Good. Great. Okay. Good.
Now, Steve uses the example of Gerald Jampolsky, MD, who wrote Love is Letting Go of Fear, who thought he had an organic back disease, and yet there was a small voice inside which said that even though I had an organic back syndrome, I was causing my own pain. It became clear to me that my back condition became worse when I was under emotional stress, particularly when I was fearful and holding a grievance against someone. And then Steve says that Dr. Jampolsky had seen the light in the 70s. I went through the same process myself. I would be, and then Steve says, I would be hard pressed to look back and to find someone who was in pain, who hadn't recently had a major change, was experiencing overwhelming demands, or was holding a grudge, necessitating repression, leading to their symptoms. And I can't think of anyone. I wonder if anyone can think of anyone who didn't have those kind of preconditions prior to the onset of symptoms.
I don't know anybody that that you know hasn't been through some major stuff before the symptoms came on.
Yeah, change. Major change.
If you one of the best resources for understanding the stresses that you're going through is the Holmes-Rey stress scale. And it's used extensively, or was used extensively at Rusk by the people closest to Dr. Sarno. Dr. Eric Sherman, one of the psychologists who Dr. Sarno trained and then referred patients to, wrote a little essay about it for us at the wiki. You can find it just by typing it into the search box. But of interest is, I believe, the official name is the life something readjustment scale, because they figured out pretty quickly that let me find the official name of it. The Holmes and Ray social readjustment scale. They found that it was the readjustment that's difficult for us. You know, once we get used to something, then it no longer causes us stress, but it's those changes that Bruce was talking about that cause the most stress. Social readjustment rating scale. There we go. It allows you to rate the readjustment.
So you can take it for a long time, Forrest, and adapt to it. It's when the tension release occurs.
Right.
That you have to, and that means those programmed unconscious paradigms are real slow to change. They want to stay gripped in that, like running on autopilot.
Gripped in that old, yes, that old way of being, that old way of thinking, and then something happens and we have to readjust, and that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
In my day job is as an economist, and one of the things I study is decision making and kind of how economists think about psychology. And one of the things that we talk about is called the hedonic treadmill. Well, hedonic is like hedonism; it just means happiness. And the idea is essentially about readjustment as well. So the idea of the hedonic treadmill is that we have this certain level of happiness that we're preset to, and if we get something new, like, you know, suppose we start off as a caveman and then we get like a straw bed. At first we're really happy, but then we get used to it and then we're like, okay, whatever, it's a straw bed. We take it for granted and we're at the same level of happiness that we were before. And then we actually get a roof over our head instead of being in a cave. And for a little while we're happy, but then we readjust, we get used to this new thing, and it doesn't make us happy anymore. We just take it for granted. And then we get a little hut, and then for a little while we're happy, and then we readjust, and it doesn't make us happy anymore. And then, you know, we go from a hut to a house to a mansion, and then you've got these people who have these insane, gigantic mansions who are, who are no happier than anyone else because they're caught on the hedonic treadmill, and they haven't and eventually they adjust to all of the luxury that they have. Anyway, that was all a long way of supporting what you were saying, Bruce, this idea that it's the transitions that are really difficult for us.
Yeah, there have been a lot of transitions in the last 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
Going from the little English village to the global village, you know.
Well, and not surprisingly, chronic pain is a huge issue in our society, and depression rates are going up. Now, that could just be diagnosis, or it could be, you know, that people are having a lot of difficulty adjusting. But certainly, as you mentioned before, people are a lot of people have noticed with their TMS that they had real big changes right before their symptoms started flaring up. I know I sure did. For me, it was, you know, I was in high school, and you know, I was always been a slightly ambitious kid, but I was worried a little bit. Well, I was a little bit of a geek, and so there were stresses from that. I was kind of adjusting to puberty and everything like that. But then also there were kind of success and competitive distress, and yeah, lots of stuff that I was adjusting to back then. Still am.
Yeah, and I was taking care of my mother like a hero for 5 years, and it was driving me. It motivated
me.
Yeah, I could just give in to that stress, and just it structured everything I did, and I never had to make a choice. And the minute that ended, all the structures that have been going on for 5 years were suddenly released.
Right.
And they were redundant, and the change was going to take place.
Right.
Yeah,
I remember how that house was such a big issue for you, and all the memories that it brought back, and all of the things around that caretaking that you were having to do was tough.
As long as my mother was there for me to take care of, though, then the old structure persisted. But once she was out of the equation, then all of the haunted house syndrome, all of my attempts to avoid the pressure from the parents came right back. Bango.
Exactly.
By the way,
it makes so much sense. Yeah. And by the way, I don't mean to say that the hedonic treadmill is absolute. You know, some people, you know, some things even after the adjustment will still make you happy or sad. But it's an effect that people have noticed.
Have you heard of the Winchester Mystery House?
No, I have not. What is that?
Mrs. Winchester made all of her money making Winchester repeater rifles and selling them to the Chilean military back in the 1860s to shoot Indians.
Okay.
They went on little hunting expeditions on trains, and these repeater rifles were so efficient that it made Mrs. Winchester a multimillionaire. Well, her husband died, and then she had one son. And she invested everything in the son, her emotions, and the son died. And then she snapped. And the Winchester Mystery House is her edifice. She continued to add on to the Winchester Mystery House room after room after room with false walls and panels. And it was haunted by the ghost of her son. And she communed in there alone. It's still down in San Jose. You can walk through it. And she kept people working constantly on it. Yeah.
What happened to her?
She eventually died locked up in the house alone.
Ooh,
and it became huge and elaborate. It was one of these 19th century Victorian Gothics. And today you can walk through it. Yeah, you see what the stress, that was the stressor. Was the death of the son, and then she jumped the tracks, and she wanted to live forever. She thought she would live forever as long as she continued to build. So she built a hedonic palace that just...
Yeah, I mean, and it seems to relate to what Steve is talking about here, where, you know, she's trying to hold on to something. She's got this image of how life should be, and she's got to kind of forgive, she's got to let go of that and accept and move on, that you know, her son isn't with her anymore.
Yeah, that's why they say she was crazy. She needed to see a psychiatrist.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, you know, with me leading up, I had lost a home. I had lost over $100,000, all in a bad business deal. About two, three months later, you know, I bend over to, you know, pick up a little weight that I'd picked up 1,000 times before, and boom, you know, I'm laid down in bed for a year. So, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
so there was an economic stressor.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know about that. What did you notice with the death of Mick Jagger's girlfriend, her suicide, what had happened?
Mm-mm.
She was $5.9 million in debt, and she would not borrow money from him. and she was living in a $10 million high rise in New York. And then Mick went 10,000 miles away. Abandonment at the same time she was in debt, at the same time her pride, her ego, her need to be self-sufficient wouldn't let her ask for anything. And he was probably fooling around. And banga, she hit the wall and killed herself.
Wow.
And there's two Holmes Rahi events.
Yeah.
Big debt plus abandonment right at the same time. Bang, bang. And people said she started acting funny about a month ago when he went away because she was covering all this up. She was internalizing that debt. Well, if you're at that level, if you're, you know, $5 million in debt and you have this $1 million company, why not just declare bankruptcy and simplify?
Yeah. I mean, this plays right into, you know, one of the parts on the last page there, forgiveness. You know, you have to forgive yourself. You got to let things go. And forgiveness is the most important part.
So she was unable to forgive herself then.
Yeah. That's one of the main things that with me, when that happened to me, well, you know, about all the money and the home and everything, I could not forgive myself. I blamed myself for it. And it wasn't my fault. It was just a bad business, you know, decision. And I came to terms with that. And it went a long way when I finally did forgive myself, you know. So, wow.
If I had to give the cause of pain an emotional label, it would be guilt or shame. Guilt is a personal reaction, and shame is a social reaction to embarrassment. So it sounds like that's one of the big triggers, isn't it?
Oh man, I felt terrible. I didn't want to face my family. I didn't want to face nobody. I mean, that was, you know, I was living my dream, you know, and then it just got took and basically stolen. And wow. Anyway. A lot of us go through things, you know, like that. And that's the whole emphasis of forgiveness, you know, and letting go, you know. And the more we try to hold on to, you know, this person we used to be, when that's long gone and we just need to be happy with who we are, you know, that keeps the fire burning, you know, it keeps the pain going.
That's like that monk, isn't it? He dances through life and he's happy.
That's good.
Amidst the tragedy.
I like that. I bet you Tom dances a lot too, don't you, Tom? Somehow. When you get you a drink in your Tom.
Is he listening?
Where you at, Tom?
I don't see.
I'm sorry. I have muted Tom because there's a little bit of noise on his line.
Sorry. Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Sure.
Yeah.
Can.
Yeah. I wish I drank more. My girlfriend doesn't drink at all. So, you know, you kind of get out of the habit, but, I wish I did drink more. Takeaway. Yeah. I saw you, made a pecan punch. I'm flattered, quasi one and, Good. Did you put any grenadine
delicious.
In there?
I didn't have any grenadine, so it's very adapted, and it's Ramazzotti instead of Amarapicone.
Yeah, Ramazzotti. I'll make a note of that. Bevmo might have it. I don't know about in Boston, but out here they have. But don't worry. I think it'll do just as good as anything. But
Ramazzotti with a little bit of Angostura orange bitters.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going. Don't let me stop you.
What I take away from Steve's last chapter, and it's been thanks to this group I finished the book. Otherwise, like Steve said, I'd probably still be reading it in 2086. But I got a hit, actually, and so I finished a while ago, but I distinctly remember the last chapter was a great one, and what I took away from it was he said you have to be happy with yourself. You have to make yourself happy. If you're not happy, no one else will around you, you won't make them happy. And it's from the biblical Old Testament where there's the saying, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? So I think that's where it maybe comes from. Who wrote that?
Good.
I
like that.
Yeah, well, let's say I did. I just wrote that. I actually, it's not from the Old Testament. I just made that up, and I'll take full credit for it. But Steve-O reminded me of that. And if you're not happy with yourself, I think no one around you is going to be happy with you. You won't make anyone else happy. But if you're feeling pretty good, you're going to be a role model, an example, and everything else around you will probably eventually get on the same page as you. So it's important to make and keep yourself happy. That's what I take away from Steve-O, and I think that might be the important message of his book.
Very good. Very good.
I totally agree. Well said.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to comment on the letting go or the forgiveness or the happiness factor? Okay. Do you got anything else to add to this, Bruce or Forrest?
I just think that you see in his discussion of Robert Scherer, MD, about he's the granddaddy of that fight, flight, freeze response, isn't he? And the physical symptoms that result from the freeze response are the TMS symptoms discussed throughout this book. These symptoms result from a lack of discharge of the energy pent up by fight or flight response that never took place. Expression of conflict, the desire to be known, and yet for personal reasons cannot. And I think, again, that goes back to the Michelangelo metaphor about the image of the angel frozen in the marble. And that's what needs to be released, is that freeze response. It's frozen in the marble. And Michelangelo releases it with the chisel.
Yeah. I wonder how many people every day gets frozen like that, you know? You get in these situations and the boss is over here and he says something out of the way and you want to smack him, but you know you can't, you know? And so you just got this energy that's held inside of you, you know? And then it goes on for years, you know? But that's letting go and forgiveness, is it not? I mean, you have to practice again. Yeah. Wow.
And that's the whole creative process with Michelangelo, too. That's
how
art liberates.
This man was, Michelangelo was genius.
Oh, yeah. He sure was.
Wow. Well, it's about forgiveness and letting go, guys, and being happy. I mean, we all could add a lot more to it. Steve's book has been awesome, as I say all the time. My gosh, I mean, he this is, if you ask me, the encyclopedia of TMS healing. I mean, if you want to look into all things TMS healing, it's in Steve's book. I mean, would you agree, Bruce?
Yeah, this I told Steve when he was on that you were a TMS test bed.
Yes.
If you're doing stress testing or throughput testing, he took it to the max.
That's what
for
me and
all the rest of us.
Yes.
Beyond anything that I would do, I wouldn't go out and run every day like that and beat my brains out. Maybe a few years, maybe 20 years ago I would have. I would have been obstinate then. But luckily for us, he did it. He did it for all of us.
Pretty much to show us how strong the body is and that you can, you know, because most of us, the main thing, you know, We fear that we're going to hurt our back. We fear we're going to hurt our knee worse. We fear we're going to hurt our shoulder worse or our neck or whatever. And that's what keeps – that's the condition or trigger or whatever that keeps holding us back from doing the things we want to do. Because when you go do it, you hurt.
We're not afraid, we're afraid.
Yes. That's... Even if you say you're not afraid, you're afraid. It's a conditioned response. Yeah. I mean – there's something I still do to this day, and it's a conditioned response. And I know I have to work. I work on it, and I don't know. I think it's deadlifting. There's something way in back of my head every time I go do it. This is going to hurt, even though it don't. I still, you know, I'm past that limit, but for a long time it did.
I noticed from 20 years ago where I broke my heel when I go downstairs to run the osterizer or the dishwasher. When I'm standing there, I will still pull the heel of my left leg up a little bit to avoid contact. That was so programmed into me. And I'm sure that was the origin of the TMS that got ignited with these different tragic events, because it was held in there all those years, that conditioning.
The release somehow, you know, through the forgiveness, through the happiness, you know, getting out and just being yourself, quit hiding inside your ego and letting people know who you really are. You find release through meditations, deep breathing. I mean, it goes on and on through Steve's book and, you know, and TMS knowledge in general on what we need to do to get better. And it's more than just, you know, reading a book. You got to put a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff to work there for yourself, like the deep breathing, the meditations, the forgiveness, the you know, finding out what it is that you're doing that is making you sick or is making you hurt. What is it? Are you bored? Are you you know, are you sad? Are you feeling bad for yourself? There's something there. Always there's something there. And I think a few weeks ago somebody asked a question. I forgot what it was, but it was like, what is the main thing? What is the main thing that keeps the people in pain? And my answer was, you know, it's something they still, to me, it's something they ain't found. And it's there. It's in the books. It's in the books. It just ain't found it yet, or they looked over it and they need to go back to it. You know, sometimes they just got to go back to the basics, the 12 daily reminders of Sarno, you know, and make sure you're doing all those. There is a protocol. There is a list of things to do. You know, not just one magic bullet, right? Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Well, look, I want to open it up and ask if anybody's got any questions whatsoever now about TMS. Anything.
Well, I've only been at this for over 2 weeks. I have quit going to chiropractor, and I've quit going to physio and massage. I have not quit doing my physiotherapy exercises yet. I haven't quite found the whatever it is I need to feel about it to quit it. What do you guys think of that? Did you quit right away, or do you just wait until you do more other things and then it just sort of falls
off? I hedged my bet, and I think that's what perpetuated my symptoms. I kept going to therapy and doing the stretches long after I should have quit.
You should have quit earlier.
Yeah, from my experience now, my healing started 2 years ago when I quit all of that. That's when I started getting better. But you have to have guts. You just have to do it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's the last thing I'm holding on to.
That once you know that it's TMS, I think that exercise is great because it's good for you, because it makes you happy. And, you know, you should do exercise because exercise feels good.
Oxygen too?
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to, Dr. Sarno for a long time, he worked with some physical therapists, some great physical therapists that he had a lot of respect for at the Rusk Institute. And I don't remember exactly where he said it, but somewhere he said that it was one of the very hardest things that he's had to do to stop working with those highly trained physical therapists. But what he realized is that it was dragging people back to the physical. That being said, I mean, I think that there's also, you don't want to go too fast. You don't want to go faster than your own personal comfort level. So in the end, that's something which, you know, you want to pay attention to that as well.
But don't you think, Forrest,
if I don't pay attention to my physiotherapy while I'm doing it, then I'm not thinking about the physical. Maybe I'm watching a TV show, not really paying attention. Or maybe I'm releasing something as I'm doing something. It's like, oh, there's a feeling in that spot, so I'll release
it.
The
unconscious is so powerful. I mean, it is deep within our brain, and so it knows why you're doing the exercises. And so I guess you have to ask yourself, why are you doing the exercises? And if you're doing the exercises because you're thinking in a physically based mindset, it knows that. And that's sending a powerful message to your subconscious to say, hey, it's working. Keep it up.
Yeah.
That's a good answer, Forrest.
Yeah. Well, I can see when I quit going to chiropractor and massage, I could see what they were really doing is just spreading everything around instead of it just being in one spot. So the pain just being in one spot, it sort of spread it around. So I can see now that I've quit that that wasn't, in the end, it wasn't that helpful. But I haven't quite given up on the physiotherapy yet. Maybe I will by one of these days.
Well, in terms of getting ready to do that, I think that's where the knowledge therapy comes in. So it's amazing how many times you can reread and reread Dr. Sarno's books, and each time you get a little bit more. And so I think if you keep doing that, I think there'll be a certain point where you'll want to stop, and that'll be a good time to do it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Tom, did you want to say anything?
Anyone else?
Okay, well, that's the end of the show. It was awesome, man. This is great. We'll be on here a little bit after we're done to talk a little more about what we've been talking about.
He raised his flag. Tennis Tom raised his flag.
Yeah.
Oh, oh no! Oh, is this me? This is I muted him again. You're back. We can hear you now.
Tom? No, it's me. I apologize. It's dinner hour, and I'm munching on pistachios or rattling pages. So I take full responsibility for destroying the stereophonic theater quality of this broadcast.
You are very kind.
But I am sorry. To answer, who was the lady who was had the question about PT, physical therapy? Who was that?
Peggy.
Oh, well, the recording is on, so she doesn't have to mention her name if she doesn't want.
Oh, you don't know. Okay.
Pseudonym. You can call yourself...
I'm Peggy.
Oh.
Peggy.
Peggy. Okay, Peggy. Great girl. Okay. It's a fundamental in the books to stop doing physical therapy, except in Steve-O's book, and I agree with him, massage, things that you do for relaxation to level out your rage-soothe ratio to give you some pampering. You don't waste your money on chiropractors. I've done that. Don't waste your money on that physical therapy stuff. But massages are fine. I went to chiropractors, highly recommended, ran into Hollywood stars who were there, so highly recommended. And it was just hilarious after I was thinking, here's this big guy, and he would push down on me, and he would give this big exhalation like something really happened. And that I thought was weird. I've done like 200 acupuncture sessions, quackery, except for the part where you relax. Except the acupuncturist figured out they can have six rooms going, stick the needle in you, it takes 10 minutes, they put on a heat lamp and some nice music, and they run off to do the same thing in another room. And the studies have shown that it doesn't do anything. People are still buying that thing from when Nixon went to China and brought back acupuncture. Hey, if you want to try, tell next time you have root canal, tell your oral surgeon, hey, give me acupuncture for the pain and see how you feel. So, but massage is okay. That'll give you some true relaxation. Nice 90-minute massage or a hot tub, something that pampers you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sure.
Sounds great. Anybody else? All right. This has been a good show. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, everybody, Forrest, Tiger Lily, everybody that's talked. God bless you. And next week. Next week will be, remember, at 8 o'clock, Steve will be on here.